Welcome to the Cato Institute. My name is Marian Tupi, and I'm the Assistant Director of the Project on Global Economic Liberty. Following the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, countries of Central Europe embraced freedom, both political and economic, and embarked on joining the community of developed nations. Similarly, after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, the Baltic states embraced free markets and democracy. More recently, the people of Ukraine and the people of Georgia overthrew their autocratic regimes, and they have embraced freedom as well. Under the leadership of Russian President Vladimir Putin, however, the Russian state stepped back from free market economics and democracy. And these days, we see the Russian Federation embracing autocrats and totalitarian regimes in the near abroad. The Russian state has threatened, blackmailed, and generally undermined the democratic governments of Georgia and Ukraine at every turn. And clearly, what Russia seems to prefer these days is to deal with the likes of Alexander Lukashenko, the strongman of Belarus. Belarus attained independence in 1991, but since Alexander Lukashenko came to power in 1994, he has cracked down on his opponents and rigged successive elections. Today, Belarus lacks basic political and economic freedoms, including freedom of press, freedom of association, and freedom of expression. More recently, President Lukashenko has won another term in office with a truly Soviet 83% in favor. As a result, Lukashenko's relations with the Western community are strained. He's been called Europe's last dictator, and President Bush has called Belarus one of the outposts of tyranny. And the Belarusian economy continues to be run according to discredited socialist principles and remains heavily dependent on cheap gas from Russia. I'm very happy that we have here today two authorities on both Belarus and Russia, and they will enable us to better understand the life of the everyday life under Lukashenko in Belarus, and also the relationship between Belarus and Russia. Our first speaker is Yaroslav Romanchuk. I had a privilege of meeting Yaroslav in 2004 when Cato held a conference in Moscow on the future of liberalism, and Yaroslav was one of the speakers. Yaroslav was born in Belarus in 1966. He's the vice president of scientific research at the Mises Institute and also the vice chairman of the United Civil Party. He has authored this book, Belarus, The Road to the Future, which is really a suggestion of liberal market reforms for the parliament of Belarus and was based on Cato's Congressional Handbook. Yaroslav has been educated at the Linguistics University in Belarus and has been a prominent critic of the increasingly autocratic President Lukashenko, and I'm very happy that you are here to join us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me here, and first of all, for interest to Belarus as the last totalitarian state in Europe, where every time I talk about, use the adjective last here in the context of my Russian friends, they say, wait a minute, there's something coming. So that's why it's really It's a very good example, and we agreed with Andrei Larionov that Russia is lagging behind Belarus for 4 years. So if you guys want to know what this part of the world may look like, welcome to Belarus. Besides, that's a very good grant for research of those who really are still dreaming about government intervention into the economy, because unlike in Western Europe, this is a pure case of the government intervention that led to extremes. From that perspective, that's quite interesting, and that's not so for many people who live in Belarus. That's why my topic of the presentation is that the totalitarian state, revolution or evolution. I deliberately use the definite article here because I will be talking about Belarus primarily, but definitely I will make some points about Russia because it's getting more and more important. Do we have remnants of the past, or is it like a tendency in the region? And what kind of risk for the future do we have? Definitely, Belarus has very distinct Soviet heritage. It's the most ideologically brainwashed and economically advanced republic. These are two kind of very important pillars of the today's system. We had a very interesting fact that Belarus has the highest per capita rate of monuments to Lenin in Belarus. That kind of tells you how advanced Belarus was. And Lenin, by the way, historically has never been to Belarus, which is, makes its kind of prominence definitely ideologically based. You know, that Eastern Germany was also the kind of showcase for the Western Germany and for Europe that capitalism, socialism can work. Likewise, Belarus was a showcase for the rest of the world that the Soviet Union can also have some good example. That's why it was industrialized, it was well-developed. And people in 1991, when perestroika happened, they didn't understand what it was to be like independent country. People didn't want changes, and people, for another three years, they longed for Russia, they longed for Soviet past, and that was very powerful. That's why we had severe deficit of national identity. Belarus, you know, was unfortunate in being between Nazi Germany and communism. So German fascists destroyed many people and killed many people. Then communists got over, and so that was like another wave of communization of Belarus, when many people were sent out to Siberia, Kazakhstan from Belarus, mostly Polish population that lived in the West. So there was nobody and virtually nobody to protect national identity. And if there were some people which were smart and clever, they were sucked up by the Kremlin, by Moscow, and they worked there. And we had many prominent Russian, Soviet-style hardliners that were originally born in Belarus. We had the artificial structure of production, something that was not driven by consumer demand, but something that was driven by decision in Moscow, which was on purely ideological basis. We did not have pockets of independent thought because all the, as you know, the KGB, it's a very good example just to give you, to illustrate today's state. People, when they retired from the army, they went to Ukraine. People who retired from, let's say, government apparatus, they went to Crimea and to some other beautiful places. When KGB or special forces retired, the representative retired, they all came to Belarus. So we have a very good big concentration of the people who had this kind of uncovered their KGB past, and they are there, they live, and they definitely have an impact on what's going on in the country. And that's why the nostalgic element is there. People are nostalgic about the past, about the glorious Soviet past, and that's part of the system. Belarus now is full-fledged totalitarian state. Before the March 19th presidential campaign, we don't call that elections because we didn't have elections in Belarus since 1996. That definitely, we had some arguments whether it's a authoritarian country or totalitarian country. Now we really see that there's totalitarian state. And this is the evidence. We don't have elections. We don't have balance of powers. We don't have independence of judiciary. No human political rights and economic freedom. Number at the top, bottom 10 in the index of economic liberty, and one of the most repressed country in terms of political rights and civil liberties based on Freedom House research. No private property protection. We had a very big and very unusual network of shops called Confiscat. It's like confiscated goods. And one of examples to show you how it works, at one of the regional districts, when director of the shop ran out of detergents, he just came up to the customs officer saying, "You guys, we ran out of detergents. Why don't you confiscate something so we can have them on our supply?" So this is how it works. It's strange. It got to the point when Russian Foreign Ministry complained to Belarus about the scope of confiscated goods that were aiming going through the territory of Belarus. We have the information monopoly. We have political prisoners and elimination of political opponents. Essentially, right now, one of the presidential contenders, Mr. Sandro Kazulin, is in prison. He was accused of hooliganism, of course, and he faces up to 6 years in prison. Information, political, financial, and energy support of Russia. This is a very important fact. I will talk about it later. What kind of contribution did we get from the West when the Soviet Union collapsed? That refers not only to Belarus, that refers to Russia, to Ukraine, that refers and only to Central and Eastern Europe. So everybody saw democracy without understanding that as magic, a three-in-one, magic wand, lamp of Aladdin, and goldfish. Any wishes? Welcome. So huge moral hazards caused to very inflated expectations of the people about what democracy can bring. So people saw these wonderful pictures from Germany primarily because that was too difficult for them and too expensive to go to United States. Like, you know, cars, plenty of food, everything is chic, right? That's the thought that once they got democracy, in a magic fashion, something that would appear. And they were very disillusioned, and that disillusionment came from misunderstanding of the concept of democracy, that it never happened. France definitely was a role model of capitalism that is definitely tells you what kind of understanding of capitalism was. And we really shiver now, and especially in Cairo, if you call France a capitalist country. In terms of policy advising, Sachs, Galbraith, Stiglitz, a paradigm known as Washington Consensus, was used as a blueprint for reforms. There was no libertarian alternative for post-socialist countries. We just talked about damage of taxation, big government. Well, we welcomed privatization, private property, but we needed some mechanisms, some tools to campaign and to rely upon to be kind of piece of legislation that wasn't there, because I do not know any libertarian at that time in the beginning of the 90s who could really have a contribution to the public debate. Third way was the ultimate strategic direction of development. That was kind of, let's combine the best qualities and features of the socialist economy and social system, which was described by many as moral, as cultural, as aesthetic, contrary to the West, the capitalism that was associated with Schwarzenegger, Rambo, third-rate Hollywood movies, as they do not have access to good movies, good books, and that was kind of a message that was sent. Intellectual, financial, technical support from major international organizations with obvious agenda. You know what World Bank, IMF stand for, EBRD, European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, OECD, the organization that campaigns heavily against tax competition. So it's definitely not the guys you expect consistent liberalism from. And what another interesting factor, again, moral relativism and postmodernist culture. Everything became relative. And instead of campaigning for consistency in in describing ideological foundations for capitalism, for free market economy, that was left alone to be interpreted by the organizations and parties that used to be very sympathetic to the Soviet Union. That's why, that's one of the major issues why now, after 16, 17 years of reforms, there is no consent for free market, no support for capitalism in post-socialist countries, and that's why we have this growing animosity and hostility towards the West. In Belarus, the restoration of socialism began in 1994 when Lukashenko got elected, and so he based his approach, ascendance into power, by consolidating pro-totalitarian collectivist forces. He got full control over money flows and assets. There were many ruthless, fanatically thirsty for power individuals who did not know and didn't care about division of power and even democratic principles. There was domination of Marxism and collectivism ideologies, poor quality of government administration, and what is more important, possibility of international recognition after taking power by at least one major influential country. And I mean, that's obvious what country I have in mind. That's Russia, because without Russia's support and political approval of what's going on in Belarus for the next 10 years, this kind of totalitarian state would have never survived politically, and I would tell later economically too. We had very poorly developed media market and structure of the civil society. That's why there was no resistance from this important institution to the state as well. So we've witnessed restoration of redistribution schemes. Inflation in the beginning of the 90s, we had about 2,000% inflation. Now we have a little bit less than 10% inflation, but I would like to tell you that this doesn't matter. I don't trust in this number because we don't have free prices in Belarus at all. Every price rise by a private company must get approval by one of the state bodies, which its job it is. Negative deposit interest rates. So you go to the bank and you put the money into the deposits, and just remind you that Belarusians don't have the culture of investment thinking. So they think that money is in the bank, well, there's some interest rate, and so you get it. So, but they did not take into account inflation that was like with a deposit interest rate were about 20 to 30%, inflation was 300%. So that was the way households subsidized the state without knowing it. Multiple exchange rate. That was another wonderful cash earning mechanism for many people who were close to the authorities, because we had like 7 exchange rates. And if somebody has access to exchange rate of the national bank, so he can do that, sell at market rate, and he can become a millionaire within 1 year. That was very lucrative, and many people got rich in Belarus like that. Belarus failed to have any new big companies in, let's say, top 100 producers of the country. They channeled the resources of the biggest existing 100 companies to ensure their kind of profitability and their employment there. Of course, the internal market, domestic market, was severely protected. And moreover, which is very surprising even to our Russian colleagues, that we don't have even the single market inside the country. So let's say if I have a company in Minsk, capital of Belarus, I want to sell goods to Vitebsk or to Brest, I cannot do that freely if I am beyond the quota. And the quota, let's say, of locally sold goods in the retail, let's say in Bobruisk, which is kind of a small provincial city of 150,000 people, is 90%. So that tells you that Belarus essentially is like the country of 7 feudums. Fiefdoms, where there is no free flow of capital of goods at all. Surprisingly, because for me, everybody who supports our regime definitely sooner or later will follow suit. And we have a lot of evidence that Russia is doing that because Putin himself talked about managed democracy. Putin and instead of like liberalizing and turning energy companies into full competitive open corporations, monopolizes and turns the different sectors into oligopolies. He's been again pursuing active industrial policy, meaning all the like set of tools you are aware of. They use energy as a political weapon, which is very we saw that in Ukraine, now in Georgia, in Moldova, now we saw that in Belarus. Whether it will happen, it's another case. Centralization of decision-making process is speeding up. Full control over mass media, civil society, and recently Gazprom announced that it is buying the biggest Belarusian daily, Komsomolskaya Pravda. The owners of that newspaper were kind of forced to sell, otherwise they won't be able to operate. So essentially there are no TV channels left, no newspapers, major newspapers left, where you can have an alternative to Putin regime. Full control of ideological support of Russian Orthodox Church that challenges Western civilization. That's a new development, but I think that is one of the most disturbing one in the next 16 years. The thing is that in the beginning of April, a Russian Orthodox Church, and that refers also to Belarus and Ukraine because the church operates in these two countries, passed the Declaration of Human Rights and Dignity. That's kind of the document that challenges the Western attitude to human rights and liberties, and that says that that begins this kind of period of time when Russia wants to be the third Rome again. It muscles its power, it's rich in oil and gas dollars, and it wants to have a different attitude, role in the world. It plays tricks with Belarus, it plays tricks with Iran, with Palestine, with Hamas. So it's getting very, very different right now. So the dangers of new totalitarian access, which Belarus and Russia can be a part of. So, of course, Russian authorities and most predominantly Russian politicians don't want to see Belarus as an independent state. They think that it's a historical mistake they must correct. So they support rogue states and increasing risk of international military conflicts. The thing is that what disturbed me was that Russian Minister of Defense sold the brand new anti-missile system to Belarus. And incidentally, Belarusian authorities sanctioned, opened up the assembly line of Iranian cars. Have you ever seen an Iranian car around? Something that definitely justifies floats and transportation between the two countries. And I suspect that that may have something to do with anti-missile defense system of Iran. So this kind of behavior definitely discredits international organizations, OEC, Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, Council of Europe, which is a body that unites 46 European countries, but Belarus, G8, UN. Russia is chairing, as you know, G8 summit in St. Petersburg. Russia is taking chairmanship in the Council of Ministers of Council of Europe. So what kind of message do we get from these organizations that allegedly should be based on values, democracy, human rights, and fair and transparent international relations? That means that we're sanctioning that. We are sanctioning that. We are giving free rein to the people who really are turning the district, that part of the world, into totalitarian axis. Definitely that weakens basic Western values and free market institutions, as we cannot combat this kind of policy because we are the West predominantly now is getting more morally relative. We don't know. The question I always ask in the beginning of the 90s, Soviet Marxism is the ideology of socialism. So what is the ideology of capitalism? No answer. Kant, Heidegger, or Ayn Rand? Nobody knows. at least in the institutions that are responsible for shaping ideological policies. So we are witnessing a restoration of the Berlin Wall in that part of the world, and what is more disturbing, we are facing acceleration of the crisis in Europe. Belarusian television is pleased to show these pictures from France, where the authorities used tear gas against demonstration. There's like 3 million people in the street against liberalization of labor market. We have the same kind of problems in Germany, in Holland, and this is kind of welfare state that is breaking apart is considered to be a good model by very many ideologues in Russia and Belarus. So then there is intensification of the attack on the USA, because if Iran got its nuclear weapons, and allegedly that's a matter of time, if there's a conflict between Israel and Iran, they say that's a question of time, that may happen by the end of this year. So definitely United States may not feel that secure, and its foreign policy definitely needs to be adjusted to reality. So what are the potential for evolutionary reforms in Belarus? So in order to have evolutionary processes, we need consolidation of Belarusian democratic forces, business community, and youth. That is, we have a coalition of democratic forces. We have a coalition of youth organizations. We are missing the element of business community. And that's what we've been working on. I know what your attitude to the state is, but essentially American state has been helping us a lot. And I just mentioned one SIPE project. It's a Center for International Private Enterprise that we've been working on to essentially develop a business coalition and to get it and to let it be aware of what private property is and how it is interconnected with democratic values and sustainable development. Intense, adequate information campaign, that's what we need in order to get the message out. It's getting more and more difficult with the severe deficit of information. When I had a meeting at State Department, I think that really we should think about free satellite TV channel in the Russian language to cover Ukraine, Russia, and Belarus, because I think in the near future there won't be any free and essentially objective coverage of these enterprises. Instead of having like 25 different projects, we definitely should think about having the efforts consolidated under this kind of attempt. Reduction of Russia's support may effectively kill the Belarusian regime economically, and as you know, there are different estimates of Russia's support to Belarus that vary from 11% to 13% of GDP. Just imagine what kind of blow the centrally planned economy could get if it is deprived of this kind of subsidy and the market, Russian market, access to Russian market. I know of any country in the world in the recent history that got this kind of support. That's why it's when they say that, well, Belarus is sustainable, it's good, it's nice, it's clean. Well, with this kind of money from a foreign state, which definitely has its own agenda, it's kind of easier. Consolidation of transatlantic access. No matter what you think about France or Germany, I think that it's very important for us to get this kind of policy together and have the common grounds based on Western values and to defend Western civilization. I would think and look for a word which is alternative to the word crusade, because that's what we need. Moral crusade in defense of our values and culture. Otherwise, I mean, ours, libertarian, ours, conservative, which are from the perspective of my country, very close to one another. So we need the accumulation of investment and administrative mistakes of the centrally planned economy to collapse, which is happening. And there is definitely a risk of banking and budgetary crisis. Belarus faces says that it has balanced budget, but if you take into account all expenditures, the deficit is about 6% of GDP. What are the prerequisites for revolution? So the state should weaken, and neutrality of force structure should be ensured. That's not the case yet. conflicts among ruling bodies and individuals, that is going on, that is happening. The Lukashenko environment is not homogeneous. Deterioration of social standards with kind of Russian support, it's difficult to assess from inside because Belarusians have very low expectations. And you know, this is kind of a Russian saying about social security standards in Belarus. Unless you don't have bombs falling on your head, you are happy with a piece of lard and a glass of vodka. If you have that, well, you have pictures from Russia, from Chechnya, you have pictures from Iraq, you have pictures from France, you have pictures from Poland with 33% unemployed young people. And in this kind of information monopoly, you really feel kind of inclined to believe that Belarus may be a good country. Outside pressure on the regime should accelerate, and deterioration of economic and legal conditions of entrepreneurs and small businesses. Again, this is where the authorities feel most likely the danger from. And so time is coming to make a choice. Either this is the window you see from on your left or window you see on your right. And this is essentially, it's not like black and white. I wish it was. In economic theory, it is. When you read Mises, right, so it's economic socialism is doomed, but it doesn't say when. So it doesn't say what kind of domestic conditions should be, what kind of international assistance should be. But I'm sure that sooner or later the choice should be made. So we should really describe these things as this, black and white in many cases. So we should be getting ready for change, and that's what we've been doing. We're producing intellectual ammunition, like the books that Marian kindly showed you. We challenge government policies on very many issues. We designed our tax policy, tax reform, budgetary reform, healthcare. I'm proud to also to present to Belarusian authority the pension reform based on Jose Pinera ideas. So that's what we've been doing. Creating authoritative intellectual alternative, creating economists, supporting economists, intellectuals from Belarus, integrating them into the Western society, Western community, building grassroots support for change. That's what we've been doing with SAI project, with different other U.S. projects that are quite active in Belarus. So if you weigh the support for Belarusian opposition for change between Europe and USA, well, it's like probably 1 to 10. Challenging the regime's values and morality, winning not just minds but hearts and souls. So usually when I talk to different audiences, I don't recall macroeconomic models. People, GDP per se is meaningless in Belarus because, you know, I can give you like 10 examples how you can corrupt this index. And even when I talk to directors of state and private enterprises, they say, what we give to government authorities and what we have in reality, these are like two worlds, like two windows that you saw. That's why you don't believe the statistics. They lie. So we use metaphors, we lose emotional connotations, and I drafted the program for social economic reforms for the single candidate for the opposition. I talked about such things as health, as value, family, as truth, as education, as job creation. So when we libertarians in America, I think that we should also stick to the thing that people find very important, not just to talk about the things that may be interested for very, very limited number of individuals. We are forging national movement based on coalition of political parties, civil society, and business community, and we are getting Belarus on the agenda of transatlantic coalition. Our single candidate met prime ministers, presidents, and that gives it's not only security, because if he disappears somehow, people would know that it's not because he got a deal with some thieves, but definitely the reason is quite different. So what challenges do we have ahead? We have to mobilize human capital. We have to ensure technical and financial support for our activities. We have to ensure access to media. And access to media in our case is leaflets, primarily door-to-door campaign, talking to people, using every opportunity. That's what we have. And unfortunately, we don't have any access to television at all. So we have to form networks, and networks vary. So it shouldn't necessarily be network of political parties or NGOs. Those are networks of entrepreneurs, businesses, people who really care. After March 19th presidential elections events, we have what I call prison brotherhood. This is like 1,500 young people who are in prison and who really are determined to fight to the end. And they are really the backbone of the future freedom movement. We should have adequate marketing of ideas. That's where really can cater and authoritative intellectual institutions can help. We should challenge new forms of statism and collectivism represented by UN, EU sometimes, and many other universities of with renowned names like Berkeley, like Sorbonne. So they still have this renown, this authority among post in our countries. We should personalize freedom movement. And that's very important because every set of ideas should have a face which is attractive, which is intelligent, which is sexy, which is fashionable. If you don't have the face, that's difficult to sell ideas. Finally, we should redefine West, which is sometimes you may find strange to do, but is France the West? That's the question I always ask when I analyze what's going on in France. So is it geographical? Is it moral? Is it is it basis on institutional, organizational, foundation? What is it? So thinking this is what we should think about if we really want totalitarian states to become history. What kind of forms of assistance? Again, this is standard things. We talk about political support, intellectual support, information supply, moral solidarity, and I'm really grateful to cater to SAIB, to very many cases, U.S. government for this kind of support. We're talking about investment in viable structures and projects. We're talking about winning the battle of ideas and making a strong case for Western civilization. You know what changed my attitude to this life and to the World of Ideas was just one book. This is the book that I really strongly recommend to everybody in Russia and Belarus and Ukraine to read, which is Atlas Shrugged. And unfortunately, many people in Europe don't know what it is. So that's why we don't necessarily should concentrate on macroeconomic models and econometrics, which is damaging. We should really invest in spreading 1 million copies of Atlas Shrugged in that part of the world. And if that's we do that... If we both force and money are impotent against ideas, this is Ludwig von Mises' quote, and I would just urge everybody to join Freedom Crusade. Is that what will make totalitarianism history? We can do that. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Yaroslav. I'm really pleased that you haven't lost any of that passion. I remember when we were walking down the Red Square in Moscow, and we went to visit Lenin in his mausoleum. And I'm happy to say that, except for the two of us and a bunch of American tourists, there were no people there. let's hope that's how it's going to stay. Well, the second speaker today I have a pleasure to introduce is Dr. Anders Aslund. He is a specialist in post-communist economic transformation, especially in Russian and Ukrainian economies. He is currently at the Institute for International Economics here in Washington, and for a decade prior to that, he worked at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he was the senior associate and later director of the Russian and Eurasian program. He's also an adjunct professor at Georgetown University and served as a government advisor to the Russian government, Ukrainian government, as well as the president of the Kyrgyz Republic. He's the author of 6 books, including Building Capitalism, How Russia Became Market Economy, Gorbachev's Struggle for Economic Reform, and so on. He is published very widely. His articles have appeared in Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy, National Interest, New York Times, Washington Post, Financial Times, and Wall Street Journal. He has obtained his Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of Stockholm and also a doctorate from Oxford University, St. Anthony's College, 1982, and it is my pleasure to welcome into Cato.
Thank you very much, Marianne, and it's a pleasure to be here at the Cato Institute again, and in particular to comment upon Jaroslav Romanchuk's very extensive and good presentation of what he and others are doing in Belarus today. I visited Belarus the first time just after the Chernobyl catastrophe 20 years ago. And the first impressions I had then, I lived in Moscow at the time, were quite surprising. Belarus stood out as the place where the Soviet economy worked better than anywhere else. It was much cleaner than anywhere else. And what surprised me most was that wherever I went, service people refused to take tips just because it was forbidden, something that nobody anywhere else in the Soviet Union would care about. And I really got the impression, very much on lines with what Jaroslav described, this is the Prussia of the Soviet Union. More militarized, more orderly, more disciplined. And of course, that's no good for building democracy, as we have seen in the real Prussia. Jaroslav covered a great many of aspects, and my intention is really to focus on two economic issues. One is the rather amazing economic results that Jaroslav did not go deeply into, and another that he didn't discuss more in detail, and that is Russia's role. So if we look upon the Belarusian economy, of course Jaroslav is perfectly right, and I would, this is a surviving Soviet-style economy, and I think that there's one fact that is important. It says it all. 80% state ownership. It's only Turkmenistan that can compete with Belarus in this regard, not even Uzbekistan. And this means that there are no strong independent businessmen. I think that's the fundamental political weakness of Belarus. And this is a huge difference from Georgia, Ukraine, Kyrgyzstan, and also Russia. Admittedly, we are now seeing a big renationalization in Russia, but so far this makes the situation for a democracy look much worse in Belarus than elsewhere. And my point here is just simple. For democratization, any privatization is better than no privatization. But let me turn to my first topic here. It's the amazing economic results. Belarus has officially had a GDP growth of 11% and 9% in the last 2 years. What is the source of this growth? It's export-led. Exports have grown by double digits in the last 5 of the last 6 years, and it surged by 36% in 2004. The current account has been a problem, but last year's was finally in slight surplus. The external debt is small, only 18% of GDP. Admittedly, foreign direct investment is minimal in the country. The financial stabilization has been the main problem, and inflation reached 10%, that is down to 10% only last year. But the black exchange rate really disappeared in 2001. So how can this Belarusian economic dynamism be explained? I would put it in three essential explanations. The first is that this is a regional economic boom we are seeing, and it's lifting all ships. And Belarus is actually below the CIS average. So this is no wonder. It's just slightly worse than average. As Jaroslav mentioned, we shouldn't take these statistics too seriously. They are exaggerated. but the World Bank and the European Commission do take them seriously, and they have done certain studies of it. So say that the exaggeration can hardly be more than 2 to 3 percentage units on the growth rate. And the main answer here is really increasing Russian subsidization of the Belarus economy. And this comes in two forms. The first is export of crude oil and natural gas at prices below the market price. And the other form is the purchase of Belarusian manufacturers that would otherwise have little value. Seems to have disappeared, the last line. And that's tractors and other machinery that could not be sold on the world market. So in order to figure this out, I, of course, looked up the Russian foreign trade statistics. And in the statistical yearbook for last year, I saw quite a surprise. The Russian foreign trade statistics after the end of the Soviet Union has normally divided the world into two spheres. Near abroad, that is the CIS, and the rest of the world. Now, on the contrary, in the latest issue that is just out, you read the world in three parts: near abroad, the rest of the world, and then comes Belarus as a special category. I don't know what political message the statistical yearbook wants to make with this, but it makes it very clear what the statistics are. So therefore, the statistics are surprisingly good. Oh, here it came. So first, let us look upon the natural gas imports. The volume is 19 billion cubic meters, and the in 2005, it's rising every year. The price for Belarus was $47 per 1,000 cubic meters, while the net back price from Europe was $150 per 1,000 cubic meters. It means here we have a subsidy of pretty exactly $2 billion, only on gas. And crude oil imports, here there is less of a subsidy, only $1.3 billion. So if we put this together, the Russian oil and gas subsidy last year was $3.3 billion for oil and gas. And that amounts to 11% of Belarus GDP in 2005. And these are just the official numbers. There's nothing hidden in this. And a peculiarity with this is that this is rising with world oil and gas prices, because import prices are stable, but the world prices have been going up. So this can explain a substantial part of the increase in the last 2 years. So it's really Russia's subsidies that Belarus seems to have to thank for the increased growth in the two last years. And as you have probably heard in the news now recently, 3 weeks ago, one of Gazprom's vice chairman announced that Belarus will now have to pay market prices as everybody else from the beginning of next year. And this would mean to Belarus a cost of a current subsidy of $2 billion a year. And this would amount to almost 7% of GDP. I think that this is the most important thing that seems to be currently going on. And this would eliminate Belarus's economic growth, and naturally this would lead to political destabilization of Lukashenko at the same time. So the question today is really, is Russia or Gazprom really choosing between profits or empire. You may note that Gazprom today is worth $230 billion, almost one-third of Russia's GDP in comparative value. And at the same time, we are seeing something that is quite serious in Belarus's internal development. And that is that this extraordinary honesty in Belarus seems to be going away. Hardly any country has seen such a deterioration in the Transparent International Corruption Perception Index as Belarus has done in the last 4 years. It has moved from being as honest as Estonia or Hungary to being as dishonest as Ukraine and Kazakhstan, which are a quite corrupt country. So what we are seeing here is really that corruption is getting out of control. And if you are losing control over corruption, you are also losing control over state control. So what conclusions do I come to? Well, I think that the first conclusion is that Belarus is actually getting quite interesting after having been shockingly stable for a long time. The biggest question I have is not really in Minsk, but in Moscow. Is Russia getting tired of subsidization? Is the current Russian leadership more interested in profits than in empire? And civic resistance shows that fear is abating in Belarus today, as Yaroslav so vividly illustrates before us here. And then finally, corruption is undermining state control. So to my mind, this does not look as stable as it used to do. Thank you.
Thank you for that fascinating presentation. Let me misuse my my position here as a moderator to ask the first question, and then we'll, of course, open it up to question and answer session. I want to ask of both of you, let's assume that the GDP growth is really overestimated by only 3 or 4%. Is there a sign on the on the streets of Belarus that the economy is actually ticking along quite nicely or not? I ask that because during the years of the Soviet Union, we kept on constantly overestimating economic growth in the USSR. The CIA claimed that standard of living in the USSR was same as that in Spain, that East Germany was as wealthy as Great Britain and so on, because most of these GDP figures were simply complete fabrications. So is there a reason to treat those figures with like it's true or not? Thanks.
Good point. First, about the theory. You know that economy, unlike mathematics or physics, you cannot make experiments, reverse it back, and then compare results. You cannot say what would have happened in Belarus had it applied a different model. But we can say that, let's say, Baltic states that definitely took a different turn both in political and economic policies, and its growth rate is higher. Investment attracted to these countries definitely is much higher. Salaries in these countries are higher. Wages, pensioners are higher. So you see even human development index is better. Competitiveness is higher. So if Belarus had taken different policy, had acquired democracy and moved closer to Europe, then definitely it would have been better off. We are kind of surprised that streets are clean, but, you know, Minsk was the cleanest cities in the Soviet Union without Lukashenko. So how could we have it as an asset to, that refer that to the current economic policies? You know, it's like, you know, we have some a joke among ourselves that if the government takes responsibility for something, it is sure to fail. It tries to it formed the union state between Russia and Belarus. Now we had a huge drop in trade between Russia and Belarus. So it began the program of import substitution. We have surge of import. So no matter what you take, right, you have housing program. Now we have the prices for your houses and utilities that are like $1,500 per one square meter of housing, which is very, very expensive for Minsk and Belarus, where the average pension is $100 and average salary is one of about $250. As for GDP, I commented on that. And as for clean streets, there is another very pure market incentive explanation. In cleaners, street cleaners, are very well paid. Their salaries range from $300 to $400, plus they can get some more by stealing from the state. And besides, they have very good access to cheap credit. So it's from the perspective of some financial benefits, it's get better to be a clean street cleaner in Minsk than a doctor. And that definitely market phenomenon.
Yeah, no, sure, Marianne, there's a lot in what you're saying, and we shouldn't take these numbers all too seriously. Belarus essentially has all the old Soviet-type economic distortions with an important caveat, and that is that you have a private sector of officially 20% of the economy, and these are services that are close to the consumers. So this looks to a considerable extent like Poland in the 1980s before the transformation. I do think that there is a serious structural problem that Belarus has excellent Soviet machine building. The good thing is that it's excellent. The bad thing is that it's Soviet. So I looked up on the for the biggest export items of Belarus to Russia, which says a lot: trucks, tractors, refrigerators. So the Belarusian enterprises are now exporting a lot, but essentially only to Russia, because their quality is still good enough for the still not too demanding Russian market. But that is quickly becoming more demanding, and then Belarus's machine building will see serious structural problems. And this is true for much of Belarusian manufacturing.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll open it up to question and answers. I will ask you to please wait for the microphone to come to you and then to introduce yourselves, and please make your questions short and in a form of a question. Gentlemen in the back.
Thank you. I'm John Bertu with the National Taxpayers Union. Professor Asland, you gave a nice presentation on the amount of subsidy going from the Russians to Belarus. And I'm curious, you didn't say much about what the Russians believe they're getting. I as a person who doesn't know much about Belarus, I guess my assumption is it's support in international relations, support for the CIS. But given the numbers that you cited, that seems like an extraordinary amount of money for a country like Russia that has economic problems to pay for very little return. And so I'm wondering if you can say more what Russia gets for that. And if it is indeed only that, perhaps that does seem to support your idea that you know, the Russians may get tired of this subsidy.
Well, part of this comes from this Russian, Belarusian union that was concluded at the end of 1993 and has never been consummated. And you can say that it means extremely little, but it does mean, for example, that they are supposed to have a customs union. And part of it has been that Russia has as a sort of complement to Belarus because it wanted to be politically so close to it, in particular given lower gas prices. But now Gazprom seems to be most interested, frankly, in its market capitalization, does not want to pay these subsidies any longer. So the answer is there were political reasons, somewhat murky and very much pushed through by the more backward parts of the Kremlin. And today, even the backward parts of the Kremlin are very commercially oriented and want to make a profit. So at least what we are saying now officially and publicly is that we are no longer prepared to pay these subsidies.
Let me add one comment to that. If you desegregate Russia, you see the essence of this kind of subsidization, because this is the way, these are the schemes to steal from both Belarusian and Russian budget by typical Soviet style or sometimes Western style money price transfer schemes. If you sell oil, crude oil, to Belarus at prices that sometimes are 10 times lower than world prices, then you process the oil, you pay less taxes to Russian budget, you pay less taxes to Belarusian budget, and these prices, this kind of profit is transferred somewhere to offshore company, and they shared, like in the rate, 70 to Russian oligarchs and 30 to Belarusian partners. I think that's you cannot prove that documentarily, but I think this is the case. And so this is the essence of this kind of subsidization mechanism. And that's why when Gref, Russian Minister of Economy, or Russian Prime Minister, are talking about market relations with Belarus, that means that they are getting tired of Russian oligarchs stealing from the Russian budget. As simple as that. So it's not altruism per se. That's just typical transfer mechanisms.
Right in front.
At Nigel Atwood, Institute for Humane Studies. Could Yaroslav, could you comment on the situation in the universities among professors and students?
You mean, do they drink beer together? Of course, there is monopoly of education and economic and scientific research. You can hardly think about anything that... that presumes pluralism, but at the same time there is a lot of sympathy to independent researchers. I'm on very good terms with a lot of economics professors and teachers at universities. I do a lot of research and seminars with them. I provide them literature, books. So we are very good terms, and they are very eager to take part in independent projects, provided they I cannot mention their names. Like in the book that I showed that to you, well, there are many people from National Bank, Ministry of Finance, who took part in this, in the work, in our joint project. But they say, well, please don't mention our names, because that will just put them in a very difficult situation in the job market. That's why, you know, it's really in Belarusian universities, I think in Belarus is the only country that pays attention to ideology, because all universities, private universities included, must have ideology course. But Lukashenko is not somebody who really somebody who really understands communism even. He's like, you know, he thinks that Stalinism is okay, that Stalin contributed a lot to the country, to the development of that part of the world. But teachers who are forced to teach ideology, they say, well, you want us to teach that? We'll teach whatever you want. So that's like hidden sabotage is there. That was the case in the Soviet Union in the 80s. I think that is the case for Belarus too. And students definitely, no matter what, there's a huge intimidation campaign for students. Like every 2 days before the elections, KGB boss came out on national television and said, everybody who would take part in the demonstration the day after elections would be considered a terrorist and will face to 8 years in prison. 30,000 people showed up, and many students too, including students of state universities. And that gives you an idea how really students treat the regime.
Hello, my name is Andrew Evans. This is a question for both speakers. I'd just like to ask about the role of diplomacy in the near future. I think during Lukashenko's last election, Belarus was very interesting and then quickly became non-interesting to the rest of the world. What do you see for the future based on EU sanctions, et cetera?
You start.
There are no EU sanctions. When we talk about visa ban for 32 people, I do not think this is a sanction. This is like the estimate of the contribution of a few individuals into the fraud scheme that happened in Belarus. The Council of Europe made a very clear report making accusations or allegations of involvement of some government officials into crimes and the disappearance of leading Belarusian politicians. And the authorities just failed to have a thorough, transparent investigation. That means that these are the crimes that the authorities would sooner or later will be responsible for. It's overblown because the Belarusian authorities definitely would like to see the West or European Union, the USA, as isolating Belarus. I do not see isolation. We can go out and into Belarus. Students are not prevented from going out unless they have a permission from the Minister of Education. Even teachers, in order to take part in a conference, must have this kind of permission. There are no special resolutions on economic sanctions. I'm against economic sanctions because they will never work because we have open borders with Belarus, with Russia and Ukraine, and that will just damage the democratic forces. So I would like to have more consistency in information support, in political support, in technical support, because we have people who really have been working active in Belarus for a long time. NDI, IRI, SIPE, you have IREX that deals with media projects. We have some European institutions. And if you really ask them what should be done with request, also advising people in Belarus, then we really can get more value to $1 added to the democratization in Belarus.
Yeah, I would like to add something that I think is very important there, to go after the money of the top officials. Here it is two specific banks that seem to hold the Lukashenko family's money. It has been a strife within the European Union whether these accounts should be frozen or not. I'm not quite sure what has the outcome has been. They should be frozen. I think that's essential, and that's a really effective sanction that should be undertaken. On trade sanctions, I totally agree with Yaroslav. We see whenever there is a trade sanction, it means that the crooks, like Milosevic and Saddam Hussein, get a monopoly over foreign trade that they can easily control. And it means that the top of the regime not only gets more corrupted, but particularly it gets richer. And that's not an interest. We should really learn from these two countries not to impose sanctions. On the contrary, we should work for trade integration of Belarus. And I think that this is the most serious exposure. On top of this, visas, it's vital to liberalize visas for ordinary people, in particular in the European Union. And here we have had the absurd situation that the Polish government, that has persistently been interested in having a liberal visa regime or no visa regime for Belarus, has been forced by the Schengen agreement within the European Union to impose visas on Belarusians, and also impose forced to impose higher fees than are feasible for Belarusians. So one should let the people come out, pursue exactly the same strategy as the West pursued with regard to solidarity in Poland in the 1980s, and not try to undertake sanctions against the people over the economy, only against the bank accounts of the leaders.
Essentially, this whole talk about bank account is overblown because, you know, having so many ways to hide money in the West that the West elaborated, it really would be very stupid to have an account on anybody's name. I'm sure that there are many ways, and Lukashenko is not that dumb to have an account on his name. That's why he openly said, if you find an account on my name, please confiscate the money. So let's just forget about it and be serious. As for the visa thing, allow the Schengen procedures. If that happens, then Belarusian would have to pay $65-$60 per visa to go to Lithuania and Poland, and that would be the most effective isolationist policy that we really stand up against. We met Barroso, we met Merkel, Mr. Solana, all. I don't know who else we should meet in order to pass this message, but European bureaucracy just takes another 3 years to understand it.
Well, so come democracy to your country, will you be the first in line to join the EU?
I wrote a non-paper on EU Belarusian relations. For Belarus, it's not integrating into European democracy. For us, it's about value choice, and the EU is considered by many Belarusians as something that it has democracy, it has rule of law, has political and economic competition. So they don't understand what it is, but still, without a very huge, very severe campaign against EU, 37-40% of Belarusians would like to join EU. So my idea is first to work, have like free trade arrangement with that, and within 20 years, I think that EU will transform itself into that.
Very good. Dr. Palmer.
Thank you. Tom Palmer, the Cato Institute. I have a question about strategic thinking in opposition. One of the things that's important is to peel away layers of the onion, that is to say, elements that are currently supporting a regime, and neutralize them. Either say life will be better for you, or at least it won't be worse. Is there willingness in the opposition to make a kind of a deal, like the Hungarian liberals made at the end of the communist regime, which is, just go. We won't confiscate your houses. There were no show trials in Hungary. They didn't take their fabulous houses in Lake Balaton. They kept all of their pensions. They just said, let us just be free. Is that a commitment that the opposition would openly make? And are those the sort of negotiations that you would anticipate being in place?
Very good question. It takes two to tango. Opposition leaders on numerous occasions said that they would let Lukashenko go. He would have a state pension. He would be left alone, provided he does not commit criminal crimes. That's just one condition. I think that is fair in any case. That's the case that was made by Yushchenko in terms of Kuchma involvement in her different activities. And during the recent campaign, also both candidates said that that's not about personality. That's not the fight against Lukashenko. That's the fight for the future of Belarus. That's why the book is not about like criticizing Lukashenko regime. That the book is about future of Belarus. On numerous occasions, I made even draft laws, sent them to the parliament and to the presidential administrations, offering intellectual assistance, offering the dialogue. But I think that it will take another probably 6 months for Lukashenko to understand that there should be this kind of a dialogue, because he faces very difficult situation when no matter what moves he make, he's a loser. First, he's not likely to sell to Russia, because that would mean that he will be like number 91 person in the hierarchy of Russian political power, and he'll be condemned by Belarusians. European Union, I don't think that he will hold free and fair presidential elections and would voluntarily resign. And there is third sector, which is really getting more critical, which is small and medium-sized businesses. This 20% that are regulated, 20% that generate a lot of profit and work much better. And so I saw signs. When we proposed National Business Platform that we worked out with our American colleagues, I was so surprised to get very positive feedback from Belarusian television. So I wasn't invited because I'm kind of persona non grata on Belarusian television, but our partner who is with business associations had an access to television, and he was praised by many commentators that finally business community is constructive in its dialogue with authorities. So we are ready for the authorities to come up with kind of proposal, but I think it will take some more psychological and political pressure from Russia to do that.
Okay, one last question. Gentleman in the back. Yes, sir.
Can you hear me okay? Yeah. I'm Dane von Brackenrockert with the United States Bill of Rights Foundation. I was wondering how much of an impact or lack of impact what's going on with the Internet insofar as infiltrating, the communist regime is, and are they censoring things or computers prolific? Are they out there? I mean, kind of give us an overview of how the Internet is playing into all of this.
Internet is becoming very, very important, more and more important. 25% of households use that. It's definitely much less than in any Western country. About 50% of young people to 25 years old use the computer as internet as a source of information. And recent political campaign, we used it more and more to promote our programs, to inform people what's going on about the actions. And it's really picking up, which is very good. At the same time, Belarus bought brand new high-tech equipment to censor that. That's something that they got a deal with China. And I think that Wi-Fi internet, wireless internet, is banned. It's not allowed. Satellite internet is not allowed. That's why Belarusian telecommunication monopoly, Bell Telecom, has this cable that is the only source of incoming and outgoing information. That's why when we have different election campaigns and it's crucial for the people to get information, major opposition websites are shut down. And when you click, like, say, Chatter 97 or UCP or whatever, you've got porno sites instead. That was the case in the last two campaigns, but we definitely are determined to use more and more internet because it's definitely growing and there are ways to overcome these difficulties.
Well, okay, one more, but very quickly. Over, right in front.
This is a sort of a follow-up question. Internet is great, but isn't it somewhat preaching to the convinced? We're informing the part of the population that best informed. Tell me, outside of what's available now, what sort of information medium would be most effective for the next couple of years?
You mean couple of years, like five? I think that still internet, because in 5 years, I think that everybody would have internet. Even China is not showing a good example. But the most effective media right now, and it was, leaflets and brochures that we distribute through door-to-door campaign. This is the best way to have a contact with the people, to tell them we're not devils that are spies from the West that were hired to destroy free and sovereign Belarus. We are just ordinary people who would like to live in a better country. And from my experience, I tried to run for the parliament twice, and that's what I did. I myself went from door to door. My colleagues, like 100, 150 people, went with my program and with my information.
Outside world.
From outside. Okay, but in this case, it's still the same. We have television, we have radio that are quite limited, we have Radio Liberty that is had the audience of about 3% of the population, but this is one of the best projects that we had in this electronic media. That's why every time we talk about serious Western involvement into Belarus, we say, listen, people in Washington, in the Washington D.C., people in Brussels or Berlin, why just to sit together and have one big major TV station for the whole country instead of having like a program approved by EU, €2 million program, which is like 30-minute broadcasting on the cable Russian television with probably access to 0.1% of the population. So this is inadequacy. There are some resources there, but resources are not used in the best way. So, but that's not the information that Belarusians need from the outside world. They need the information from Belarus because that's what they interest them. What kind of conditions are, and definitely when they talk to the people, they get everything they want. Information campaign is definitely the biggest challenge, and we are determined to essentially to work on that. And I think there is growing understanding between State Department, between donor community, private donors in the United States and Europe, and people who are active inside the country.
Dr. Aslan, yeah, last comment.
Let me add here a little bit. I've recently edited a book on Revolution in Orange together with Michael McFaul, and we had Alyona Priturla, the editor-in-chief of Ukrainska Pravda, the leading internet newspaper in Ukraine, writing about the role media played in the Orange Revolution. And I think this is very much the picture that we should expect for the future in Belarus also, and it's very much in line with what Yaroslav said. The internet is vital. Ukrainska Pravda has a steady readership of 70,000 people, and it has a budget of $42,000 a year. You don't get cheaper and you don't get more accurate than that. And what they had in particular was a relaying of regional news from various parts of the country. What really matters is that you can get information very swiftly about what is happening in the country when things start happening. And the second thing was that Ukraine had an independent television channel. You wouldn't hope for that in Belarus. But the question is what you can do eventually with satellite television or with certain neighboring countries. Third source that was important in Ukraine was Zirka Nedelya, a very heavy, serious, independent weekly newspaper. And the fourth that we shouldn't forget during the demonstrations itself was mobile phones that can be used for all kinds of messaging. And Belarus is perfectly modern when it comes to mobile phones, so that will probably play a greater role in Belarus than it did in Ukraine even. While two sources did not play any significant role, that was daily newspapers, which are awful in Ukraine, and the radio, both domestic and foreign. They simply did not keep up with the news flow in the same way as the internet did.
Well, thank you very much to both of you. You've been excellent, and good luck with promoting freedom in Belarus.